Hello and welcome to QS Cast. Each week we take a look at the big stories in Magic Finance and give you the story on what's worth buying and selling. If you're subscribed to Quiet Speculation's Insider Service, you're hearing this podcast on Wednesday. If you're not already signed up, you had to wait till Friday to hear this. If you're not familiar with the Insider Service, head on over to quietspeculation.com and you'll find out about all the ways we can help you pay less money to play Magic. All right, guys, so this week we are going to be talking about, first of all, Chaz is going to tell us about his new article series on QS. It is free. It's pretty cool. He's breathing some new life into some interesting cards. We're going to talk about some spikes that happened. We're going to talk about some market corrections that happened this week. And we're also going to talk about some tournaments. Now, first of all, this was kind of a slow week because in America we had Thanksgiving, which falls on a Thursday every year, which means that there's not a lot of big events that happen. And also because it's a Thursday, there's not much that happens either on Wednesday or Friday. So for our international listeners, I hope you'll understand this may be a slightly shorter episode than you're used to, but we still want to get you the best information we can this week. Chaz, could you tell us about your new series called Scrap Savant on QS?
Yeah, sure. It's a free side article series that I started up on QS, and I've been trying to do it for a while and piecing together, you know, how best to do it. And I wanted to run it on QS as just a great kind of series that people can read on the free side. And mainly what it deals with is evaluating these bulk cards that a lot of people end up accumulating in their collections undoubtedly as they go along and play the game. And this series is just a fun way to look at these bulk cards, use a bunch of them in a deck, and try to grind some games on MTGO and, you know, see if we can build something viable. And a couple of the articles are out. You can see the first deck that we built around. It was Felidar Sovereign and Brutal Expulsion. So we made this kind of Jeskai life gain. I dubbed it Life for Jeskai, a homage to StarCraft, if any of you play StarCraft out there. But yeah, it's just an interesting way to evaluate these bulk cards and, you know, maybe find cards that are just better than initially thought. I mean, people tend to cast a lot of cards aside, and without this series, you know, I never would have stumbled upon like cards like Arc Bond as like kind of a really good way to deal with a Tarka Red. I mean, you could see in the video, really helped us out in that first game. But yeah, the premise of the article is just that building with bulk cards, giving me a good way to play MTGO on the cheap and learning the program, and for people to, you know, as a community project, build these decks around bulk cards.
And, you know, doing that, probably uncovering a couple other gems that people might use in Commander or things like that as well, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, it really, you know, when I put up the polling and it's a bunch of different cards, they're all bulk. We usually build the cards with other bulk cards alongside that, and then I get to, you know, kind of suggest cards for an additional budget. Again, this is for people that really would like just a budget way to get into the game, have a semi-viable deck, and they can add additional funds to the deck and additional upgrades. Like for this particular deck, I added Soulfire Grandmaster, Exquisite Firecraft, Radiant Flames. It really just kind of opens people's eyes to cards that, again, are casted aside and can be used in a multitude of formats. I know I'm mostly starting with Standard, but if there's demand, I could certainly branch into other formats.
One of the important things about your project, Chaz, is that it works really well on Magic Online because the bulk rares have a much lower price floor than they do on paper. So like in my article a couple weeks ago, I talked about how bulk rares end up being worth a penny because they have zero utility as a game piece. And I like what you're doing here because it takes those pennies and it says, well, first of all, some of these may not actually be pennies. They may be dollars in real life. But people on Magic Online like to pass judgment on cards. And when a card is deemed unimportant, it quickly drops to that minimum price. So something like Felidar Sovereign, you're going to look at it and go, this is obviously a stupid casual card because it's a big, dumb creature with a goofy alternate win condition. And everybody knows life gain is bad, right? But I like what you did here. And you found synergies like Soulfire Grandmaster plus Arc Bond, which you have a Felidar Sovereign out and you can snap off an Arc Bond with Grandmaster out and you probably win the game. So it's one of those things where cards are not as bad as they seem when you force yourself to play them in context. And on Magic Online, the rewards are so much greater for getting both rares correct.
And one thing to throw in there, too, is that playing Magic is fun, and that, you know, when we play Magic online, we're playing, you know, we're playing to win, but you don't always have to play $1,000 decks to win if you set your goals to be lower, and maybe playing, like, a 10-ticket deck and winning with it may be a little bit more fun than having, or maybe as fun as, or comparable funness to having, like, a fully powered standard deck.
For example, I was talking to Chaz about this. I in my casual paper decks, I play 40-card pauper singleton, but the idea is to build competitive singleton decks that sort of play like high-powered draft decks. It's just a great case study, yet another case study for why you don't have to pay the most to have fun playing Magic and win games. If you're trying to win above all, at all costs, if you're a tournament grinder, if your only goal is maximum victory, then yeah, you have to be willing to shell out the bankroll for the mathematically best and most successful cards, which are almost always going to be the most expensive ones. But if you're just goofing around on Magic Online like I am, and like you said, Doug, playing Magic cards is fun. He likes playing Magic. And playing Magic Online is great because you can do it from your own home. You can play in your underwear at 10 p.m. Not that I ever do that, you know. So you can just kind of goof around for $50. And like $50 is the cost of an expensive board game or a night at the bar with your friends or something, you know, something like that. So when you really look at it as like the replacement value of entertainment costs, if you're not trying to win above all else, then it works out to be a very efficient way to have a lot of fun.
I was really happy with the reception of this series, and I'm really glad you guys like were you're so into it to have it on the site. And I think it was a good way to present the series again for free, and you know have people. I mean, we have this podcast. We talk about insider stuff. We talk about a lot of finance stuff. And one thing that I've found myself talking about more recently is just the price of standard and. That is like a huge barrier to a lot of people. And here, you know, with this series, you can start with something concrete and then build on that. And, you know, this is really the bare minimum. I mean, there's a lot of budget stuff out there. There's some really good budget stuff out there. Notably, you know, someone that I also do a podcast with, Seth Saffron Olive, that does really good stuff. But, you know, I wanted to take that one step further where, you know, you're spending $25 on this deck as I plugged it in, or 2.48 tickets on Magic the Gathering Online. And, you know, I think that's like a really good way to get better at deck building, evaluating cards when you're put like when you put restrictions on yourself. I think that's the best way to find better cards. And here, you know, you have a bare minimum, like $25. And then the next step is add this card. And then the next step is add this card. And then finally you have, you know, in this case, like Soulfire Grandmaster as kind of the top of the curve in terms of what you're spending on a budget.
Even Soulfire Grandmaster is considerably cheaper on Magic Online than it is on paper.
Right.
So even the place of the Soulfire Grandmasters, which we discussed on chat last week, makes the deck, I mean, I think it makes the deck 10 times better. For an extra $20 is, you know, if you're thinking in terms of a Magic budget, $20 for a playset of a Keystone card that's one of the best cards in the format is really not a lot. So I think the time has come for Magic players to really start to realize Magic isn't just standard. Magic isn't just modern. It isn't legacy. It isn't tournaments. It isn't winning. It's about a fun game that gives you difficult decisions to make both in deck building and in playing. It exposes you to other people. It helps you make friends. It gives you new ideas. And it's just an outright very fun game to play. And I think that people fall into a trap of thinking, well, the only way I'm going to have fun playing Magic is if I bring the best deck I can to standard Friday Night Magic and I go 4-0 and win tons of packs. But Magic is one of those games. It's called a collectible card game, but back in the day, it was called a customizable card game because there were no the sense of formats was very loose. You could just do whatever you want, and we've seen people taking advantage of that customization in the sort of non-starter format that was Tiny Leaders. And you know, you can kind of just take Magic cards as game pieces and put them together in whatever combination makes the most sense.
So big spikes that happened this week, and that is Reiterate. And Reiterate was curious because nobody could quite figure out why it was going up. Reiterate is a card from Time Spiral. It's one red, duplicate a spell, and it has buyback for 3 mana. So the only previous use of Reiterate was that you would use Firemind's Insight and grab Reiterate, Reset, and Lightning Bolt in EDH so that you could generate infinite mana and Lightning Bolt people out, which was cool enough. But Reiterate had a low enough supply, and I think people decided it had started going up that some people made some major moves on buying it, and it briefly was listed for $40 on TCG Player, which is only the result of the bottom 90% of the cards being scooped out. It has since price corrected to about $11. And Chaz, I want to throw it to you. Do you think that Reiterate was justified even going up to $11, or do you think it's going to drop further, especially when we know that there's no real new combo or demand from it?
Okay, so this is like a little out of my comfort zone. I would have to peg this on strictly like Commander demand mostly. I don't know. I haven't really researched it. Other than that, I didn't really see too much of a catalyst other than the new Mizzix of the Ismagus, generating a lot of hype.
Isis of the Mizzix of the Nizzix of the.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you know, this stuff happens, and more often than not, it doesn't really stick. There could be demand, but there's not a lot of price. There weren't a lot of them to begin with, so I understand that. It quickly price corrected, but, you know, as people are, or I should say financiers, get shipped these cards and start listing them to undercut each other, I mean, this is going to try drive down, you know, a lot to a lot saner price point, I think, not so wacky, but it's still going to be end up more than where it was. I think it was like under $2, $1.50 or somewhere around there. And, you know, so that I guess in the grand scheme of things, you made out. But the main thing on these specifically, when you have such a drastic and, you know, sudden price spike, is you really have to watch the buy lists. And if the buy lists don't really budge at all, then you're kind of, it's going to be kind of hard to get rid of these. I mean, you're going to have to be undercutting constantly, and you don't really have a good out because you don't have any of the buy lists. If they're not, if they don't update their buy list, then they don't see this as a card that they need to be buying because there's a lot of demand. If they don't.
Yeah. You know, I'll jump with you on that, too.
Yeah.
I looked it up, and that ABU Games is currently paying the most for these, and they're only paying $3.13 for Reiterate. So there's an ocean of difference in that price, and I think that that's probably a lot closer. I'm guessing based on a $3 buy list that we'll eventually see these settle down to $5 or $6. So, you know, don't buy into the trend of Reiterate here.
Right. And like I said, I mean, not to say that, like, you know, EDH can't move prices. It definitely can, but I mean, sometimes when these drastic buyouts and these drastic spikes happen, I mean, you have to kind of take them all with a grain of salt. I mean, most of the time they don't really stick, but at the same time, they will likely be higher than they were initially. But again, with these, you really have to look at the buy list, and like you said, Doug, the buy list maybe moved a little bit, but it's not, you know, it's not high enough that it was really worth the time to go out and buy like 20 Reiterates or something. But you know, if you did and they were under, you know, if they were a dollar or something, you can buy with them for three, then great. If not, you could just move along and continue to buy into the gradual stocks, as I say, the slow gainers of modern stuff that's coming up. A lot more, you know, modern iteration is innovation, I should say, is going on. We'll talk about that in a little bit with the recent tournaments. But yeah, I mean, like I said, I don't really play the game of all these crazy price spikes. I'd rather just use that money better. Opportunity cost is a real thing here, and I kind of will like to use that money for more copies of Splinter Twin or what have you, and just keep going along.
Well, we saw a price correction recently in Modern. Protean Hulk and Footsteps of the Goryeo both shot up based on the resurgence of the Bubble Hulk deck. Just as you were saying, Chaz, people got their copies and they listed them. Two of the biggest losers over the last week. Protean Hulk dropped 31% down to $7.50. Footsteps of the Goryeo, the uncommon from Saviors of Kamigawa, dropped from a little over $7. It dropped nearly half its price down to $4. So the people who got these copies are listing them. The stores that wanted to acquire them or got bought out, they're lowering their buy lists. These card stocks are just being replenished. And it may also be the case that people aren't selling them for the prices that they want, so they just keep edging their prices lower because they have to get their money out.
Right, yeah, same thing for Protean Hulk and Footsteps. I mean, it is a deck. It does well enough, but again, it's not like premier stuff. I don't even think it's as good as the Grizzle Shoal brand or whatever deck you want to call that. And that caused some really crazy price spikes too. On some cards that I really never thought it would stick. But you know, here we are months later and, Nourishing Shoal is still like an $8 card. So,
yeah, so maybe you know, we should take this occasion to take a look at the modern results then. This is drawing from the Star City IQ this weekend in Somerset. And that was won by a Goryeo's Vengeance deck. It looks like the finals was a Goryeo's Vengeance deck versus a green-red aggro deck, which sounds like the most boring, uninteractive finals that you could plan. Green-red aggro has nothing in it that can really interact with that and stop a combo going off like that, except for he has Path to Exile and Gaddock Teague, so he has a little bit of something there. The Goryeo's Vengeance deck is a deck that I did not think would have any lasting impact in Modern, and I think for the most part it really hasn't, since it's so soft to cards like Path. And all sorts of removal, dispel, cards like that. But it is interesting to see it taking down an event, especially looking at the rest of the top eight. You have Twin, which is just a normal combo deck we know, but there's also Scapeshift and Ad Nauseam in the top four. So three of the top four decks were combo decks, which is not normal, I suppose. There's not a great representation of Affinity across the top 16. And, you look at a tournament top eight and then you look at what's not there. And one of the things I looked at, for the standard top eight was that there is no Jeskai deck, Jeskai, Dark Jeskai, whatever we want to call it. There's none of that in the top eight. There's not even any of it in the top 16. And that deck seems to have been solely replaced, like entirely, with Esper Dragons is the deck that you play if you want to be flipping Jace. So I'll just throw that out to you guys. What are your thoughts on the loss of Jeskai? What are your thoughts on combo-centric Modern? We can just kind of be all over the place on this.
Yeah, Modern is great in terms of you get to see different decks place well and do well like almost every event. In Brussels, we saw a lot of Twin and Affinity in the Star City Games. In this Star City Games top eight, not so much. So the one constant has still been Scapeshift, and I don't know how many times I want to talk about that. I'm going to be like the Scapeshift guy at some point.
Yeah,
but
you don't
want to
turn into the Scapeshift guy.
Yeah, so...
Better Scapeshift guy than Wasteland guy.
What?
Better Scapeshift guy than Wasteland guy.
Yeah, seriously. But here we go again, like, Scapeshift adding blue back in, Doug, and we see four Snapcaster Mages and four Tarmogoyfs. So
those Tarmogoyfs were the craziest part. It's like, either they worked for him and they were real good at, like, getting the life total down, or he really didn't believe he'd actually be able to Scapeshift people out, because Tarmogoyf is such an audible when you're playing decks. It's like, oh, I'm playing Twin. Better jam four Goyfs in there. I don't know whether I'm going to be able to actually Twin people.
Yeah.
Let me jump in on that.
Interesting. Yeah, go ahead.
We were talking about this in the pre-show, and I think that the fact that we are seeing cards like Tarmogoyf appear in Scapeshift lists tells us a lot about Modern. And my sort of thesis here is that Modern is about two things. Part one is deck cores, like the Scapeshift combo or the Splinter Twin combo or the Ad Nauseam combo. Cores that involve infinite combos or things or powerful synergies, as well as like core packages like Snapcaster, Delver, Lightning Bolts, things of that nature. That's part A. And part B are just inherently powerful cards. Those are like, you know, Tarmogoyf and again, Snapcaster Mage that pretty much shine in any context. So I think we're coming to realize that Modern is half about finding the core strategy you intend to win with, whether that core strategy is comboing off infinitely, not infinitely, or just attacking with creatures or controlling the game. But it's evolving towards where you should probably be playing Tarmogoyf in decks that can cast it, because it's just one of the best creatures. It's a great attacker. It's a great blocker. And that's all. Every deck needs attackers and blockers. I mean, unless you are just hardcore turn two dredge style combo, then you still need guys to defend. You still need ways to reduce their life total by incremental amounts in the event that you can't combo off. So I think we're going to continue seeing evolutions of things like Splinter Twin running Tarmogoyf and Bounding Krasis as opposed to running a Krasis instead of running, say, the Fever Exarch. You go more controlling when you run the Exarch. You run more aggro when you run the Krasis. And as a result, you can play different flavors of the core Twin engine by saying, well, my game plan is to combo off a Splinter Twin, and I'm going to do that by forcing you to deal with my aggressive strategy rather than forcing you to grinding you out with remands and snapcaster mages and things like that until you're out of gas and I can force through my combo. So Scapeshift X is the same way. You can just go gung-ho over the combo. You can protect it with control elements, or you can force them to deal with your aggressive threats while you set up your combo and they're in a bad position. And I think that makes for a really healthy format. I don't think we can say, quote, Splinter Twin won this event. I think we can say that a deck with Splinter Twin won the event, but it's really becoming more important to talk about the context around these engines and these cores as opposed to just the one win con of the deck. And as a result, I think we're going to start to see other cards come to the fore when people realize, like, hey, when you combine core A with powerful cards B, C, and D, this one particular card, I don't have one in mind, but I'll start keeping an eye out. This particular card has above average synergy and thus becomes an above average card. So I think it means we have a healthy format.
Yeah, we saw that with Living End put in Splinter Twin, by the way, was one of those kind of things where you jam stuff together.
Perfect example. Yeah, absolutely.
One thing that interested me, by the way, about the Esper Dragons decks, and one of the questions that keeps coming up, and this is like a Snapcaster Mage question, it's a Jace question, is how many instants do you have to run to make it good? And I was really fascinated. I'm looking at the second place list by Joseph Nassif, and he's got four Jaces, obviously, but he's got 23 spells, and then there's two Clash of Wills, four Silumgar Scorn, three Scatter the Winds. That's nine counter spells right there. And then the rest is, he's got, I think, a total of 14 spells that don't actually counter stuff. Which is to say, he's got a total of only 14 cards he can snap back with Jace. That goes to show the power of the card Jace as a looter, as just a merfolk looter, with the ability that occasionally he's going to transform and buy you back an Utter End, or a Dig Through Time. And when we're looking at, like, what's the lower end of something, I think we have to keep, like, we talked about this previously, like, how do you evaluate a card that just comes out? Well, I think with Jace, it's like, you have to see how few actual good instants you can, or sorceries you can run and get away with it. Cause I'm looking at the sideboard. I mean, there's two Surge of Righteousness, an Ultimate Prize, two Crux of Fate, three Duress, and an Infinite Obliteration, which is to say, there are a few good things on there to snap back. I definitely would want to be buying back Duress with Jace if I had that opportunity against a lot of decks. But it's not this situation where you'd look at, say the Prowess decks from cons and say, like, well, now you have to run 30 non-creature spells and then, like, three dudes to make any of this work. Jace apparently works on a very, very lean budget as far as snap castable spells go.
So you're definitely getting your value out of things. If you activate it twice, you're obviously way ahead. But, yeah, I want to jump back to the Esper Dragons question because I am sitting on a stack of all of those dragon uncommons, like Silumgar Scorn, which is a 2-mana hard counter if you reveal or control a dragon. Foul Tongue Invocation, which is a 3-mana instant edict that gains you 4 life if you control a dragon. Draconic Roar, which is a 2-mana lightning bolt that also bolts their controller if you control a dragon. Those three pretty much the ones I'm looking at. And I have a fairly significant stack of each of them. I figure they've got about a year left in standard. They're cheap. They don't buy us very well. What are your thoughts on continuing to accumulate those, you know, into the multiple hundred range in preparation for post-rotation when the Dragon's deck loses absolutely nothing but Crux of Fate? Do you think they're a good place to put money? Because I've seen when buylists go up for uncommons, they'll buy a couple dozen at once. So it's like one of those things where I think they're a good investment, but I'm actually not super confident in it. I just want to check my intuition, see what you guys think.
Yeah, I think we talked about this a few weeks back, and here we are. You know, we still see these cards even played now, and I think they are a pretty good investment in terms of having these uncommons to play with. Now, remember, Silkrab did the exact same thing. I mean, Silkrab was largely glazed over and never even thought about until the most recent standard, where you're trying to get rid of a lot of high impact cards under three mana. You know, Jays, Soulfire Grandmaster, Hangerback Walker. So, I mean, you still have Silkrat, but now, you know, you're losing a lot of other stuff. And basically, Silumgar Scorn is going to, in turn, become a lot better of even a removal spell now that Dragons is now basically the only set left of the cons block. And you still have a lot of the most viable dragons to pair them with. I mean, you still have Ojutai. You're going to lose Silumgar the Drifting Death, but you'll gain Silumgar the Dragon Lord. I think those are really good uncommons to hold on to. Silumgar Scorn probably more than Falotong Invocation, but I mean, both are still really good. I just like the Silumgar Scorn a little more just because it's basically just a free counterspell, in a standard format where you're losing a lot of the cons block and you're condensing the card pool. So, yeah.
What would your price target be for Silumgar Scorn?
Well,
as far as what would you be trying to purchase them at, not what your long-term goal is?
Right. Well, see, the thing is I bought a bunch of them a while back. Like, I think, 16 of them at, 90 cents a pop. And I thought that was a pretty good deal back then because I figured it was going to do something along the lines of Silkrat. So now I basically have to double down, to bring my average down. So,
Right. I got lucky because Card Kingdom was selling them for 40 cents a piece. And I
bought
146 of them with store credit over the course of a couple of weeks, which I think is just fine, but I'm still underwater as far as buy lists are concerned. Buy lists are no more than a quarter right now.
Yeah, I mean, 50 cents or under, I mean, would be 50 cents being like the max I would even pay. And even then, so I like them at 49 cents, obviously. Card Kingdom, you can get a good amount of them for 49 cents. But, you know, if I have to pay the extra 10 cents, but I can buy 50 of them at a time, with free shipping, obviously I might lean towards that. So it really depends, because, like, if you're going to buy them at 30 cents, but then you pay X shipping, you're kind of still not in the green here. So if you can pay 60 cents but free shipping, you can get a ton of them. That's still good, I think. Right now in TCG Player, there's one of the vendors selling a bunch of them for 67 cents shipped, and you could buy like 60 of them. So
yeah, there's no reason to pay for shipping when you're buying that many of a single card. I mean, you can almost always get some merchant to give you free shipping. And Card Kingdom does free shipping on everything over $25, and their shipping is amazing. They send the cards in little plastic cases, which I actually use for my casual decks. And you can only buy 20 of an uncommon at once from them and 8 of a rare. But what I learned is if they have stock, they immediately restock after the order. So what I'll do is I'll buy like before I bought like 4 Abbots of Carol Keep or 8 Abbots of Carol Keep and then 20 Silumgar Scorns. And then maybe it's 20 or 40 of the uncommon. I forget.
I think it's 20. I think it's 20.
Yeah. Okay. But anyway, so like I would just do that to get my order to $25 and then put in another order for the next 20 and then just keep doing that until they didn't have any more or I was out of store credit. And I kind of felt bad because I'm making them send extra packages when they could just combine shipping and save money. But I mean, it's their rules, not mine. I'm just doing what their site allows me to do. So it's one of those things where the site has only X number of cards listed. Buy them out and see if they relist them, because you may get surprised.
Yeah. Yeah, just switching back to Modern real quick, like, I know you guys were talking about Jason, and yeah, I mean, Jason in Standard, even playing a bunch of counter spells is still really valuable. Obviously, in Modern, it's a little different because you don't want to play that many counter spells in a deck where you really need Jace's activations on stuff like Cole Against Command, Terminate, stuff like that. So, it's a lot different in Modern in terms of how you get the value out of your Jace, but it's definitely seen a significant drop off in Standard. It's pretty much just delegated to the Esper Dragons list now. Like you said, Doug, Jeskai Black has largely been MIA for a while, so it's either people just don't want to pay for Jace, because I've seen a ton of Atarka red-black dragons, Landfall, basically anything to play to get out of playing a ton of Jace. At this point, I mean, the teamer blacklists and these new blue, what was it? It was like a green-blue Eldrazi ramp, and I think it was played at a Grand Prix by Pavel Matusik, and it was played to sixth place. Now, this was a few weeks back, but
What was it using blue for?
Well, yeah, see, that was the thing. They splashed blue for Dig Through Time and Kiora and Part the Water Veil. So, really interesting. Obviously, you're going to lose Dig Through Time, but other than that, I mean, you're not losing that much.
Is Part the Water Veil a real card?
Yeah, it's in Battle for Zendikar. I don't know how real it is in terms of viable, but...
That was my question. I know it exists. I mean,
it is a real card. No, I think the reason they are splashing blue for it is because you get those extra turns to ramp, and you get those extra turns to get Planeswalker triggers. So, because it seems really good to ramp into a Part the Water Veil, give yourself an extra breathing room, an extra turn, and then go right into a Ulamog on your extra turn. Seems like a really good spot to be in. I only bring that up because over the Black Friday weekend, unfortunately, by the time this goes up, a lot of the Black Friday Cyber Monday deals will be over. But I was seeing Kiora like under $4, so that was interesting.
Wow. Yeah, that's a really interesting angle on the ramp deck. Apparently, a 6-mana time walk is not too bad of a deal when you have 12 mana out or whatever.
And, right.
We've been seeing lists in Modern messing with the idea of taking extra turns also. And I have to wonder if there's some room for Temporal Trespass in the deck as well. Though I do like that Part the Water Veil is also a win condition. I like the diversity of Standard because it's almost like the metagame is, or finance is enforcing the metagame in a sense. It's like people are like, no, I'm not paying $300 for a place in Adjacent. That's BS. I'm going to play something else, and it's going to be a stupid green deck that ramps into big monsters, and I'm going to have fun playing Magic, and to heck with your chases. Again, I think it's just another sign of players coming to realize that if you want to play the mathematical best deck, then yes, you probably need to allocate whatever budget is necessary. But if you're just an average Magic player looking to have fun and win some games with your friends, why not put together a green / blue ramp deck where you're casting 12 mana spells to win the game, right? Why not do it? Because it's obviously viable. You win games when you play it. It may not have the mathematical win percentage of a Jeskai deck, but other than that, you know, it seems like a viable strategy, and I think a lot of the best cards in it survive rotation.
Yeah, I mean, not to shameless plug the series again, the Scraps of On series again, but you're right. Like, sometimes price does dictate what people play, and, you know, this is a lot different. This is a lot different of a time than it was back even when Callblade, which that was an expensive deck too, you know, where people were still spending a lot of money, but they were like, okay, well, I'm just going to play Callblade and that's it. I mean, people, they have gotten a little financially more aware, and people aren't willing to shell out as much money on a broader basis to play Standard. And you're absolutely right, Kelly. I feel like finance is dictating the Standard metagame a little bit. And that's where the series really comes in again. And, you know, you can find ways to build decks on a budget and, you know, at a really low budget and, you know, give yourself limitations to really find a viable deck. Again, like
free creativity. It's something that Magic players have said for years now. Mark Rosewater said it. Plenty of editors when I was getting started as a Magic writer said it. I once complained about a video segment I was given the opportunity to do. And the guy was like, you have 2 minutes, no less, no more. And I was like, man, I cannot possibly fit everything I have to say into 2 minutes. He's like, well, then you have to figure out what's worth saying and what isn't, because that's what you have. And I really, really learned a lot from that opportunity, because I realized, like, I can say a lot in 2 minutes. It just makes you think very long and hard about what is really the core of what you're saying or trying to accomplish? What are you trying to do? What deck are you trying to build, really? What is your goal? It just forces you to evaluate things through a lens that you would not otherwise look through.
Well, really this is, I mean, to go just briefly, you know, back to, you know, me as like just starting to play the game. I mentioned this on a long-winded comment on, you know, someone asking about the finance of Magic and all that, and saying, you know, Standard has become so expensive. And this is what that series is trying to do. And, you know, largely this is what I'm trying to reintroduce. I mean, I think a lot of people forgot, like, or just, you know, don't want to play the game like that anymore. Like you said in the beginning of the cast, Kelly, going back to that, you know, people want to, a lot of people just you know, they want to play the best deck. They want to win at FNM, and that's totally fine. I understand that, and I understand that Magic's expensive. But, I mean, it wasn't too long ago. I was 13 years old, and, you know, I didn't have a lot of money to spend on Magic, and I was building the decks like I'm building in this series where, you know, you don't have a ton of budget. And, you know, as I've played the game, it was a gradual process. I mean, we're in a society that's instant gratification, but, you know, I can only do it the way I know how I did it starting the game. And now, it was a gradual process. I've definitely made my fair share of terrible trades. I've, you know, built terrible decks, and I've lost countless Magic the Gathering games, and that's just part of playing the game. It's a hobby, and you have to gradually get into it.
I started playing when I was about 10 years old, when you could buy starter decks of Revised. Of course,
right.
The first thing I did after buying my starter deck and opening a dual land was buy a price guide, and that's why we're all here right now on this damn podcast, because that was the first thing I thought of, not how to play the game. So what happened was I played for most of my childhood and teenage years, took a break during college, and then in about 2007, 2008, when Morrowind Block was out, I got back into the game. And I didn't really have a whole lot of money to funnel into Magic. And so what I did was I looked at the decks that were performing well at the time. This was the era of five-color control, if people remember that, the Cruel Ultimatum, Reflecting Pool, Cryptic Command decks that were extremely expensive. They were in the same realm as Dark Jeskai today. Similar decks as well, very, very complex, lots of decision trees, lots of powerful cards jammed together with an incredibly tight mana base that can produce all five colors. And there's no way I could have afforded that deck. But I also saw that other decks were having similar success. And the mono red deck was, I think, literally not half the price. It was probably like 10 times cheaper. It was much, much cheaper. And the win percentages weren't that much worse. And so I just, you know, I bought the cards and traded for the cards for that and just played and goldfished the deck like crazy until I knew every interaction, every deck matchup. And, you know, a novice picking up five-color control would get wrecked by an experienced player piloting mono-red. So I figured most of the people I was playing against weren't going to be pro-caliber players. They're probably going to be plus or minus a few skill points, my equals. And so I figured if I'm just better with the deck I choose, it doesn't matter what deck they choose. And that ended up bearing out. I mean, I spent maybe $100 on the deck. And I went on a crazy winning streak. I'd play three or four nights a week in town and just win packs and trade those. And eventually I got up to a five-color control deck, which was a totally different animal. And it vastly increased my enjoyment of Magic because I could finally stop playing that dumb mono red deck. But it was really not about, well, I need to first raise the money to buy this crazy expensive deck. It was like, no, find the best deck that you can afford and just, if you can't invest the money, invest the time in your own play skill and your experience with the deck and the metagame, because you can always find ways to accomplish your goals without spending the maximum amount of money. It's really just a question of one resource versus the other. Either invest the time to make the money or invest the time so you don't have to.
All right, guys, I think we got to wrap it up. That brings us to the end of this episode of QS Cast. We talked about some cards that went up, some cards that went down. We looked briefly at the standard and modern performances this week with the events and chatted about Chaz's pretty cool new article series. I think you should check it out, by the way. It's on the free site of QuietSpeculation.com. There are polls there. You should go and vote because you get to direct what Chaz does every step of the way forward. And we will definitely be bringing it back every now and then to discuss on the cast in the future. So until next week, I'm Doug.
I'm Kelly.
I'm Chaz.
And you have been listening to QS Cast.